Okay, now we see a pattern begin to develop in the book that we're never told something in the book unless we're given an example of it. Yeah. Now, we like to talk about the fact that Bill was a great teacher even though he didn't know anything about teaching. And all great books and all great teachers recognize the fact that one of the greatest ways to bring a point over, to get it over, is to give examples of it. And we like to say that a good teacher and a good book will do three things for you. First, it'll tell you what it's going to tell you. And then after a while, it'll tell you what it's told you. And then when it's all through with that, it'll tell you what it's going to tell you. And then when it's all through that, it'll tell you what it's told you. And it'll do it about three times in a slightly different way. With the idea that after a while, we're going to get the idea. Now, we've already been told what the problem is in the doctor's opinion. But now then, we're going to see an example of a person who had this problem. And in the reading of Bill's story, we'll be able to see the progression of alcoholism. We'll not only see the progression of it, we'll see the hopeless condition of the mind and body that results from it. And also in Bill's story, we'll be able to see the beginning of the recovery from this disease of alcoholism. And we think Bill's story will do two or three things for us here. You know, they recognized back even then that they would never be able to see all the people throughout the United States and Canada and the rest of the world that were going to want to know this information that they had. And they knew then, as we know today, the best way to do this is through a 12-step call, one-on-one, one alcoholic sat down and talking to another one. But they knew they'd never be able to do that because they were already beginning to receive some inquiries from California and Texas and Oklahoma and Florida and etc. And there's only 40 of these guys, and they're in the northeastern part of the United States, and they knew they'd never see them on a one-on-one basis. So the book had to be good enough that it could do the same job on a 12-step call that they were doing one-on-one. It was going to be the 12-step call in print, because this would be the only alcoholic that the guy in California is going to see. And we know that when we make a 12-step call, we go out and talk to a guy. We don't talk to him about his drinking. We talk to him about our drinking. We talk to him about our disease and what alcohol has done to us. And then we talk to him about a possible means of recovery that we have used and a program of action. Well, the book does exactly the same thing with Bill's story. It describes what the doctor has just been talking about. And if we read it and study it, we should be able to identify it to the point that where we can begin to believe, yeah, this guy's much like I am. And if he's got it, probably I've got it. And if he recovered from it, maybe I can too. So we see identification, we see hope, we perhaps see the beginning of belief in Bill's story. Let's go through Bill's story a little bit and look for identification. If we aren't careful, we tend to read Bill's story and say, well, we can't identify with him. Because after all, he was a night school lawyer, lived in New York City, he was a stockbroker, he was a Yankee. And if we aren't careful, we don't think we can identify with this guy. But if we look for things to identify with rather than things to not identify with, I think we can find all we need in Bill's story. Let's go to page 2. Bill says, I took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world I was important. Well, now, I don't know about you, but I already identify with Bill Wilson. You know, that's what I've been doing all my life, that great drive to succeed and prove to the world and everybody in it that I'm just as important as they are. Bill said, my work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. I don't have any trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. By the time he had completed his law course, he says, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. But Bill was one of the first people back during this era to really begin to investigate a company. Most people back in the 20s were investing money in stocks, really not knowing what they were investing in. And there was a great boom on, and stocks were just going up and up and up and up. And Bill began to realize that you really ought to look at the company you're putting your money in. And maybe some of these that are selling so cheap, if you investigate them and see what they're selling for based upon their net worth and what they're making, that you could really find some extremely good buys. But he couldn't get his broker friends to back him up in that. So he and Lois decided they would do this on their own, taking this little $1,000 that they had saved. And they begin to travel around the country looking at these companies, investigating these companies, and sure enough, Bill became highly successful at that. He says, we gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there in the use of a large expense account. He went out and did it, and now he took it back to Wall Street and said, look what I've done. And they were so impressed that they gave him a good job, a large expense account, and backed him financially. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. And I can just see Bill, you know. He's really there now. You know, all of his ideas is gelled. He's making that money. He's living it up. He's got the position that he wanted. And he said, man, I have really arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Now, Bill's also alcoholic. He doesn't know he is, but he is. Now, he says, drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. Now, he was having trouble clear back in law school. But now then, drink is really becoming important to him. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friend terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. And I see this, you know. He's beginning to drink too much, and some of his deals are going sour. And the people that have been putting the money in, and his partners are saying, Bill, you're drinking too much. You got to slow down. You're screwing things up. And Bill said, well, to hell with it. And he became a lone wolf, and he began to go on his own. And so many of us tend to do that. He said there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of these scrapes. I've always believed everything Bill wrote, but I'm not sure about that last statement. Lois, in some of her writings, talks about one night he came home and he had on his shirt and his tie and his coat and his shoes and his socks, but there wasn't nothing on in between. Maybe he was in a blackout and didn't remember. I don't have any idea. Page 4. Abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock. 5 hours after the market closed, the ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of the tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. We've all gone broke now. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. Well, that disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. How many of us have been defeated and low and depressed, and the world has gone against us and everything was sour, and we went back to the bar? And we had a few drinks, and that old fierce determination came back and said, by God, I'll show them. They'll not do that way. They'll not do me that way again. And we get up, and we try over and over and over. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada. Bill goes up there and goes to work for this guy. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No San Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. Now, we've progressed to the point now where we really can't function. This time we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job, then lost it as the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. We're no longer drinking for fun. We're no longer drinking just to feel good. We're drinking to live now. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s. Once in a while, he'd straighten up a little, make a little deal, make a few bucks. And I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly. I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. And there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. You know, the doctor said that we really cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And once in a while, Bill could sober up and make a little money. And because of that, he still thought that he could control the situation. But gradually, things got worse. And if you're practicing alky, they're going to get worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point in 1932, and I'd somehow formed a group to buy. You know, they say that the alcoholic is a weak-willed person. Yeah, we're the strongest-willed people in the world. This guy's dying. Yet he still can put it together enough to form a group and get these people to invest some money even back during those days. He said I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. So he didn't know he was alcoholic. He took a drink a day or two prior to this thing, triggered the allergy, and he couldn't stop, and he blew the whole deal. Now, Bill said, I woke up. This had to be stopped. For the first time, he could differentiate the truth from the false. He said, man, I got to quit this stuff. He said, I ain't never going to take another drink as long as I live. He sang our national anthem. He said, I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. You know, and I believe when we swear off, we absolutely mean we're going to stop drinking. You see, we don't know we're alcoholic. We don't know we got an obsession of the mind. We don't know that we're not going to be able to stop. Hell, we're able to do anything else. And Bill was able to do anything except stop drinking. Now, the results of that is, shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve, I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I'd taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. He swore off again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. I have no trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. And that was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that, so two bottles in oblivion. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights to city and country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. And this combination soon landed me on the rocks. Bill became duly addicted. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. My brother-in-law, Dr. Leonard Strong, is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I'd been seriously ill, bodily and mentally.
This is where Dr. Silkworth gave him his opinion and sat down and told him about what we have just went over in the doctor's opinion. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in the alcoholic, that the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. You know, I will, he told him, he explained to him, Bill, you got plenty of willpower, yes, in all areas of your body, but not in this one area when it comes to combating alcohol. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Okay, now after Dr. Silkworth had gave Bill this information, Bill says, understanding myself now that he heard this information, I fared forth in high hopes for 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. And that's the expression, boy, he just went fine. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer to self-knowledge. No, but it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After the time, I returned to the hospital. And this is his second trip to the town. This was the finish, the curtains it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end in heart failures during tremors, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew then almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge in the dark, join the endless procession of sights who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends, but that was over now. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master.
We know that this is when Bill took step one. Now, he didn't know he was. But this is when he recognized that he was powerless over alcohol. This is when he recognized that alcohol had overwhelmed him, that it had become his master, and it absolutely defeated him. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on our Armistice Day, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere, which stumbled along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. And this is this fella, Ebby, up here on the wall. And Ebby called Bill up and asked if he'd come over and visit with him. And to Bill's amazement, Ebby was sober. See, Bill knew about Ebby. He and Ebby used to drink together a lot. And they'd been on lots of parties and things together. And Bill said, I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. And the last Bill had heard about Ebby is Ebby was to be committed to the state insane institution up in Vermont for alcoholic insanity. That's what they used to do with us. Treatment centers then were for those that could afford them. Though others were committed to state mental institutions for alcoholic insanity. And Bill had heard this is what had happened to Ebby, but here's Ebby right there in New York sober calling him up. And Bill said, I wondered how that guy had escaped. Well, of course he would have dinner and I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was a time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, the very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different what had happened. And Bill always said after that he really didn't know Ebby. He said, oh yeah, I knew Ebby, but said it wasn't heavy. He said there was something different about him. And it wasn't just that he was cleaned up and a shirt and a tie and clean shaven. He said there was something coming out of his eyes that was different. I pushed a drink across the table and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. And he looked at me, straight at me, simply but smilingly. He said, I've got religion. God, I'm glad that didn't happen in my kitchen. I have no idea what I would have done. But here's what Bill thought. Bill said, I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. Yeah, he had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. And then the most profound statement of all. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked.
Okay, now, remember over here earlier, he had been to Dr. Silkworth, and Dr. Silkworth had told Bill the problem. Later on, he took the first step. But he was still drinking, and that's all he had was the first step. Now, Ebby, they told him, Ebby brought Bill the simple religious idea. Simple religious idea, which was step two. And a practical program of action, which is the last 10 steps, which became the last. So, actually, Bill had the first part of the puzzle. Ebby brought him the other two pieces of the puzzle. He brought him the solution and the recovery program.
In effect, what he said to Bill was, if you are powerless over alcohol, then you're going to have to find a power greater than you are.
And this is how you find it.
In order to recover. And this is how you find that power. And he gave him some little simple concepts or steps to follow. And Bill on page 10 said he talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. Bill didn't like this at all. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past and they made me swallow hard. Bill said, I'd always believed in a power greater than myself. I'd often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith and the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that is as far as I'd gone. With ministers and the world's religions, I parted right there. I don't have any trouble identifying with Bill. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated, and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I had disregarded. I don't have any trouble identifying with Bill Wilson at all. Middle of the page. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all. This is why one alcoholic can work with another. Bill knew about Ebby. He identified with Ebby. And he knew that Ebby had a hopeless condition of the mind and body also. And he could see in Ebby that something had taken place. Had this power originated in Ebby? Certainly it had not. Page 12. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me in the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I've since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. Now here's where the squiggly writing starts. This is, of course, it's italics, but we call it squiggly writing. And we found that anything in the big book that is in squiggly writing is an extremely important point. And it behooves us to study what it says. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? In effect, what he said to Bill was, Bill, what are you worried about? What difference does it make whether you call him God, Jehovah, Yahweh, Buddha, Confucius, Great Spirit, Universal Nature? He said, Bill, just choose your own conception of God. And Bill said that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It removed the arguments. He said it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would.
Yeah, this is where Bill took step two. Now, Bill had all the aversions toward religion that most of us have. It came from his grandfather and everybody else. And throughout here, it talks about these, and he was arguing with Ebby about his concept. And Ebby said, why don't you choose your own conception? And once he took got that out of the way, then he came to believe. You know, on page 47 of our book, it says, as soon as we can believe, I'll come willing to believe, we emphatically show us we are on our way. And he says, now it was only a matter of willing to believe in a power greater than ourselves. Nothing more was required for me to make my beginning. Now he had already taken one. This is where he came to believe that a power greater than himself can restore him to sanity. This is where he took step two.
Okay, Bill now sees two parts of the puzzle. And we start back tonight, we'll see what Bill did with this information that's been given to him by Ebby. We'll see the third part of the puzzle and what happened in Bill's life because of it.
We left. Bill had just completed step two, and it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. And this is where he came to believe that a power greater than himself could restore him sanity. He came to believe that this was the solution of the dilemma he had found himself in, which Dr. Silkworth explained. At the last paragraph of page 12, thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon as the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And so it was, it had been ever since, how blind I had been. Now, you know, Bill came to believe, but remember, on Armistice Day, he had started drinking. And he was, although he was able to take the second step, he was in the grips of the alcohol, the physical craving of alcohol. And he couldn't stop drinking.
And Bill immediately started trying to go to the Oxford groups, immediately began to try to practice these little steps that Ebby had brought to him in his life. But because of the allergy, and it was so pronounced, he was absolutely unable to stop. But he would go to Oxford group meetings, and he would try to apply the steps. And gradually he got sicker and sicker, and finally it became necessary to put Bill back in the hospital again. So for the third time, he was placed back in the hospital under Dr. Silkworth for withdrawal from alcohol. On page 13. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. There, I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him. To do with me as he would, I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost.
And this is where Bill took step three.
Now, he didn't. Go ahead.
He took. It's where he made his decision, and you can we can see right plainly where he took step three.
He didn't know he was taking step three, but that's what he was doing. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since.
I ruthlessly faced my sins was step four. Became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch, step six and seven.
My schoolmate, referring to Ebby, visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
Step five.
We made a list of people I'd hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
Steps eight and nine.
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense.
Step 10.
I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my useful to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
Step 11.
My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
This is step 12, that we will have a vital spiritual experience as a result of these steps.
Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. And when a poor old alky, in order to recover, has to give up the two things that he holds nearest and dearest to his heart. Number one's alcohol, and the second one is self-centeredness. And Bill said these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted it up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Now, Bill thought he was going crazy. Thought he might be going into convulsions or DTs. He said, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. And he listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. And we know that Bill left that hospital in 1934. And we know that he didn't die until 1971. And we know that it was never necessary for Bill to take a drink from that day on for the rest of his life.
You know, we always have wondered, and there's been a lot of discussion about Bill's recovery and about this thing that happened to Bill at the town's hospital. And as we see through great study of Bill's story, that Bill actually had a spiritual experience too as a result of these steps. We can actually see in Bill's story, and as John talked on the history of the Big Book, as he said, in the spring of 1938, Bill began to write these first two chapters. And then you remember he said in December was when he wrote chapter 5. So that means Bill took the steps. Bill had taken the steps before they were written, because actually we can see them in Bill's story, where he actually took the steps. Each step is right there. And later on, he was to put these steps down for us in a fashion when he wrote chapter 5. And it's, you know, everything that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous has been proven before it's given to us. You know, the first 100, they took the steps and then they wrote the steps for us to take. They were proven before they were written. And actually, he recovered as a result of the steps, the same as we will recover as a result of the same 12 steps.
Now we'll go to page 16, and let's look at that last paragraph on page 16 for just a moment. Bill says we need, most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. You know, this is where AA really started. This is where the problem, which is what Bill already had, met the solution and found the program of action when Abby brought it to Bill in Bill's kitchen. So AA really started that day. This is where the problem met the answer and saw the solution when Abby came to visit with Bill in his kitchen. Okay, page 17. Chapter 2, there is a solution. In the doctor's opinion, we saw the problem, we saw the disease. In Bill's story, we saw a person who had the problem, an example of it. In Bill's story, we saw his recovery. And we began to think, well, maybe if this happened to this guy, that it could happen to me also. And we probably began to believe in Bill's story. Now let's see what it is that Bill really had to experience in order to recover from this disease that we've been looking at in the last two chapters. And we don't think it's by accident that this chapter 2 is called There Is a Solution. We will really begin to look at the solution now and what it really consists of.